Welcome to Health Reform, What Does It Mean? The second in ASA series of audio conferences on health reform. We hope you'll leave this call with a better understanding of the issues and opportunities in health reform. We could spend an hour or more on each of the topics that will be addressed, but today's session is an overview with more detailed calls to follow. There'll be one call per week through the middle of June, all free of charge. You can find more details and analysis of the issue on issues on ASA's Health Reform Hub. I think the easiest way to do that is to go to ASA.org's website, find the blue column on the right side of the homepage, and then press the Hub button. That should bring it all up for you. Today's agenda. In the next 40 minutes or so, we will hear from Iyara Woody, our Health Policy Associate, talking about implications for employers. Then Barbara Mannard, VP of Health Strategy on Changes in Medicare Payments. Peter Notar-Stefano, Director of Home and Community-Based Services on the many opportunities for growth of HCBS. And then Barbara Mannard again on the CLASS Act. I am pleased to introduce now Iyara Woody to discuss what health reform means to you as an employer.
Okay, thanks, Susan. For the next 10 minutes, I'm going to give you a brief overview of the immediate changes happening this year that affect employers and their group plans. And then I'm going to wrap up with some of the things that you could do now to prepare for these upcoming changes. For provisions that become effective after this year, we are having a separate conference call devoted entirely to this topic, so you'll be getting a lot more detailed information at that time, including the major changes that happen in 2014. I'll give you more information on when and how you can register for that call at the end of my talk. I also want to direct you to our website, www.asa.org, and as Susan mentioned, click on the Healthcare Reform Hub, and that link should also have a section for employers, and that section should give you all the information you need about the healthcare reform and how provisions in that reform will affect you. So let me start by telling you that the changes that go into effect this year and other years to come are intended to help decrease the price of healthcare in general, and they may potentially decrease costs for businesses as well. There are tax incentives, tax refund opportunities, and other types of incentives coming in the later years that can be beneficial for employers. So one of the provisions that's already in effect and can be a huge benefit for employers is the tax credit for small businesses. And the eligible employers are those small employers with no more than the equivalent of 25 full-time employees, average annual wages below $50,000, and they also must cover at least 50% of the total premium cost. This provision is retroactive to January 1st, which means that the premiums paid by the employer this year before the law was passed in March can be counted in calculating that credit. For the first 3 years, nonprofit businesses will be able to receive a tax credit of up to 25% of the contribution. Then for the next 3 years after that, starting in 2014 when the exchanges are up and running, those small employers who purchase coverage through the exchange will be able to receive a slightly higher tax credit of 35% of the contribution to the coverage. So if you are a small employer who offers health insurance or is thinking about offering it, you want to make sure that you take advantage of this credit right away. And this credit may apply to our smaller home and community-based service members. In June, there are two important provisions that become effective. The first one is the temporary reinsurance program for early retirees who do not qualify for Medicare. And these are the people who are 55 through 64 years of age. And basically, the law provides this temporary reinsurance program until the exchanges become available in 2014. And employers who participate in the program may qualify for reimbursement up to 80% of the cost of providing coverage. And businesses generally like this provision because some employers are really struggling to find a way to be able to keep this type of coverage for their retiree employees. Who are the most costly and who have those very high claims because of their age. So this is an opportunity for those employers who already offer it to recover some of the costs you have with the benefits. The second provision, effective in June, is the temporary high-risk pool insurance. And this is an insurance for people who have pre-existing conditions and haven't been covered under any plan for the last six months. And just like with the retiree program, this is also a temporary solution until the exchanges become available. And even though employers will not be directly involved in this, it is important to know that all employers are prohibited from disenrolling any employee from the employer-sponsored plan or encouraging any employee to disenroll only to apply for this coverage through the high-risk pool. So these are the two immediate provisions that you want to be paying close attention to. For the remaining of the year, there will be a few more provisions that will be effective come September 23rd. And I do want to point out that for these provisions, the actual effective date is either September 23rd or after the new plan year starts. And for most calendar years, this means, for most calendar year plans, this means January 1, 2011. So the first provision that I want to mention, and that has been in the news quite a bit, is the dependent coverage extension for young adults. Some of the bigger insurance companies have already adopted this, so you may want to ask your sponsored plan or your plan managers whether they are one of those plans who already extended that benefit. What the law does is it allows young adults to stay on their parents' health care plan until age 26. This applies to all plans in the individual market, all new employer plans, and existing or grandfathered plans. For the grandfathered plans, however, coverage for these dependents is only required if the child is not eligible for another employer-sponsored insurance plan. So say, for example, that they have their own coverage from their own employment. But if the employer currently offers dependent coverage for the parent, and if the child is not able to get coverage anywhere else, then the plan is required to start extending that coverage to these young adults. The plans can start covering dependent children right away if they want. As I mentioned in the beginning, some of the major ones have already. And employers have until the end of 2010 to amend their cafeteria plan language to incorporate this change. Note that for individual plans and for plans who did not offer this dependent coverage to start with, the law allows, but it does not require employers to offer it. Also, the law does not specify whether employers that do offer this coverage must contribute anything towards the premium, towards that dependent child premium. This is something that will be determined in regulation. Other provisions that become effective in September and apply to both new and existing plans are the no lifetime or annual limits restrictions. Health plans can no longer drop coverage once an individual has become a covered participant, unless it's for fraud. Health plans can no longer exclude anyone due to pre-existing conditions. And this is effective September 23rd for children under the age of 19, and then effective for everybody else in 2014. And I want to point out that employers are not required to provide any coverage at all to their employees, but if they do, then all these provisions that I just mentioned must apply equally to the part-time employees as well. The last provision that I want to mention that is effective in September is the no discrimination based on salary and wages. And this means that group health insurance plans will no longer be able to discriminate against any employee because of their salary. And this is this especially targets discrimination in favor of the higher wage employees. Any employers will also not be able to discriminate due to other privileges of employment, which do include the credit that they may receive to buy into the exchange. Although this is effective this year, prohibiting discrimination based on salary and credits will become increasingly more important as the employer responsibility provision becomes effective in 2014. And basically, I'll explain this very briefly. Basically, because of how the law is written, there may be an incentive for some employers to hire the higher wage employees who are less likely to get credit through the exchange, as otherwise they may be subject to a penalty. So it's important that you are aware of this non-discriminating rule and that you make sure that you abide by it. Again, as I mentioned in the beginning, there are many more changes happening after this year, and you can get a lot more information about all the provisions and how they may affect employers on the ASA Healthcare Reform Hub page. So I encourage you to visit that page for the finer details. The message that we want to leave you with today and what you should do now to prepare is to act on immediate changes, especially the ones that I just mentioned, and be aware and thinking about the changes that happen later on, including the big change in 2014 when the larger employers will be called on to either provide coverage or be assessed a penalty. So for the immediate changes that happen this year, if you offer insurance to your employees, make sure that your HR department is talking to your insurance company and you're both aware of the law and all the regulations and guidance that's released and that must be followed to comply. ASA will be tracking all those regulations and we'll be posting them as they're released. So keep checking back on to the ASA Hub page as we expect these regulations to be released very shortly, especially the ones that I just mentioned. And in fact, two of them have already been released and they're on the website. One thing you may want to take advantage of is if you already have an insurance broker, they can be very helpful in explaining what the law says and how you should comply. So they can be a great resource for your business. And another thing to be aware of is that employers will be responsible for preparing the enrollment material with the correct information for the new benefit year. Some plans provide employees something in writing about the benefits, so you will be able to use what they have, but make sure that even if you have that your HR department understands the details themselves, because as an employer, you will also have to comply with certain rules. And not only that, you also want to make sure that the plan that you're sponsoring is also in compliance with the law. And the last thing to remember is that the major change employers will face doesn't happen until 2014. So although you may feel the need to start preparing now, you should use some caution, especially because there are a lot of unknowns in the law and guidance and regulations for most of the provisions still need to be developed. I also want to stress that if you look ahead and start making changes that are only effective in the far off years, that it may affect your status as a grandfathered plan. Even for some of the provisions that I just mentioned that are effective in 2010, there is still no guidance on how plans should move forward while keeping their grandfathered status. And as some of you know already, keeping your grandfathered status may be important because some provisions have delayed effective dates and some may never be required at all for existing plans. So you really want to wait until more guidance and regulations is available to start planning and executing those major changes, especially the changes that happen in 2014. And lastly, since there is a lot of time left until 2014, if you don't currently offer insurance benefits, one thing that you may want to consider is start a conversation with your board about whether you should start offering healthcare benefits starting in 2014. So I'm going to conclude by letting everybody know again that there will be a follow-up call on May 20th, and this call is going to be devoted entirely to this topic. So there's going to be a lot more said at that time. The website to register for the call is the Healthcare Reform Hub page. So again, you can go to www.asa.org/healthcarereformhub.aspx. So with that, I'll transfer it over to Barbara Mannard, who's going to talk about payment issues in health reform.
Thanks, Iara. Yes, I'm going to talk about provider payments under Medicare and Medicaid in health care reform. As most people know, the twin goals of the health reform law are to provide for universal access to basic health insurance and to implement changes setting the healthcare system on a more optimal, sustainable path in terms of value, getting better outcomes for a sustainable cost. Part of the second goal, and because the health reform bill was the only legislative vehicle moving through Congress, healthcare reform includes many provisions regarding provider payments that in a different year would have been separate legislation, including measures aimed at restraining growth over time in Medicare. For example, every year there are proposals and counterproposals in Congress having to do with the Medicare update factors, that is, the market basket, or how much Medicare providers will get to account for changes in the cost of things. This happened before healthcare reform, and as the long-term solvency problems of Medicare come increasingly to the forefront, these efforts to fix the situation would have intensified this year and in the next ones to come, regardless of healthcare reform. So, before getting into the specifics of Medicare provider payments for aging services providers, let me address the one question we most frequently get related to this issue. People say, we hear that the health care reform plan costs from covering the uninsured will be paid for in large part by cuts in the Medicare program. How can that work when we know that Medicare is already facing problems and there are all those baby boomers coming? Doesn't Medicare need more money, not less, in the future? That is a good and very fair question. Confusion about this stems from the difficulty we all have in speaking of things related to how the Unified Federal Budget Accounting Rule works. And things get lost when we try and talk about that in short soundbites. Here, in brief, are the key facts. Number one, Medicare will continue to have and spend more money for more beneficiaries over the next decades. Before health care reform, the federal government was projected to spend about $6 trillion on Medicare over the next decade. After health care reform, the federal government is still projected to spend $5.6 trillion on Medicare. And that's still a very substantial increase over the past decade, reflecting continued growth in the number of beneficiaries and continued growth in the rates providers receive to care for them. The difference is that Medicare spending will now increase by a lesser amount than previously anticipated, about $450 billion less. Well, that's a big number in dollar terms, even in Washington, but a small percentage of $6 trillion. And of that $450 billion, the biggest chunk really is hospitals, who actually will see increased revenues from other sources under health care reform because many of the people who were previously uninsured now actually will have insurance. Think about it this way. Imagine yourself grateful to have a job, getting a monthly salary from your employer, and one day the employer announces that due to business difficulties, there unfortunately would be an across-the-board 10% cut starting in 3 months. So 3 months from now, your actual paycheck is reduced. That's a cut in common parlance. But think about this situation. If you personally hope to get a 5% salary increase next year, but instead only landed a 4% increase, that's a blow to your expectations, but not a cut in your current income. This second scenario, in brief, is what's going on with key aspects of the management of Medicare going forward. In addition, in health reform, there are changes to get at waste, fraud, and abuse, and certain payment system redesigns to better target scarce resources, including a number that will benefit not-for-profit providers and others who have been providing an excellent product at a good price. Number two, The Medicare savings in the health care reform bill are being credited to the Medicare trust fund, not handed over to other programs. As a result, the lifespan of Medicare's Part A trust fund will be expanded by almost somewhere between 7 and 10 years. So the money that's being saved will actually accrue to the Medicare Part A trust fund, extending its life. Now, turning back to Medicare provider payments for the near term and later. By the near term, we mean this 2010, from January of this year through December 31 of this year. Looking first at Medicare, by now, everyone, all of the Medicare relevant providers got their full market basket update for this year. It's in your payments now. That's home health agencies, hospices, and SNFs, who are our conversation about our conversation today. So that had been in doubt, but the health reform bill that passed actually did include those updates. Good news. Now, considering from now till the end of this year, for home health, hospice, and PACE, nothing happens more to payments this year. You're set for this year. For SNFs, on October 1, 2010 of this year, a couple of things will be happening. Number one, there is the implementation of the new MDS 3.0 assessment system. Number two, there are changes to how the payment system works. That's known as the RUG system, which on average will improve payments to nonprofit providers by better targeting payments for patients with more complex nursing care needs. Now, a complicating factor, which we hope is temporary, is that one aspect of the implementation of all the parts of RUGs 4 got caught in a glitch in the health care reform bill that passed, delaying certain parts of it. Now, everyone, CMS, ASA, other provider groups and interested parties, and key members of Congress are all working to undo this glitch and have the full RUGs 4 system go into effect as planned on October 1, 2010. Further details about this are in on our healthcare reform hub, and we will continue to update you on progress in this regard. Okay, what providers should do now, of course, is get details about these changes and make, especially for SNFs, make sure that your key staff are going to the training programs for MDS 3.0 and for RUGs. Plenty of those training programs are offered through the state associations, particularly on MDS 3.0, and we have a number of good pieces of information for you about the RUG system, and also where you can get additional information about that on our hub. Turning now to Medicaid, which is critical for so many of our providers. As you know, FMAP, the federal medical assistance percentage used in determining the amount of federal matching funds for state expenditures for Medicaid, the FMAP, or federal contribution, was increased for calendar year 2010 to reflect the economic recession. This increase ends December 31, 2010. States and Medicaid advocates, including us, are urging Congress vociferously to extend the increased FMAP for at least 6 months into 2011. Both the House and the Senate have passed bills that include the extension, and we are now waiting for the bills to be conferenced. What can you do? ASA is heavily involved in this, and look for any opportunity to remind your governor and your members of Congress that we need to have this FMAP increase extended. Looking beyond this year, there are numerous detailed payment provisions and changes, especially for hospice and to a somewhat lesser degree for home health agencies. There are two big things for all the post-acute care providers. First, there is a transformation of how the updates, previously automatic, will be handled. In the past, recommendations about these inflation factors were made to Congress by MedPAC, the Medicare Payment Advisory Committee, regarding the update. In recent years for post-acute care, the recommendation was inevitably to eliminate this due to overall margins in the field, which were far less for not-for-profits. Because Congress was informed of this and that this approach of eliminating the update hit the worthy and the unworthy alike, especially hit those who were spending money on patients compared to those who, as well as those who were using it otherwise, Congress would generally not change the expected update. Starting after the end of this year, however, the exact time differs among provider types. There will instead be an automatic nick in the expected inflation factor or update market basket increase for all Medicare providers. Payments will generally increase, just not as much as it might otherwise have been. This is known as the productivity adjustment. For SNFs, for example, this would reduce anticipated revenues by about $14 billion over the next 10 years. Again, a big number, less than 1% of expected expenditures. Now, the second big thing I said is that healthcare reform also sets forth a path to a better way for determining if the productivity factor NIC in expected updates will actually come to pass, or if we can get the needed savings in a better way. More on other presentations we're going to be doing about the demonstrations that will lead us to a better way. Okay, with that, I'll turn to Peter, who will talk to us about home and community-based services.
Peter, before you start, I just wanted to remind everybody that questions can be emailed to us at townhall@asa.org, or you may tweet them with the hashtag #ASA10. Thank you. Now, Peter.
I'm going to cover the payment provisions that apply to home health and hospice for this year. The 2011 to 2014 payment changes are on the ASA Healthcare Reform Hub page. For home health, this year there is a 2.2% market basket increase. Some more good is that rural home health agencies will benefit from a 3% add-on payment to their rate to offset the higher costs for staff transportation. This increase will cover rural home health services for the period April 1st, 2010, this year, to January 1st, 2016. We just added information on billing the rural add-on to the ASA website and our home health listserv. Also, the new home health payment calculator has been added to our website. The outlier cap for home health is expanded to 5% of the total payments. This provision should not impact the majority of our members. The healthcare reform bill also increases physician accountability for ordering home health. The physician, physician assistant, nurse practitioner must now document that they had a face-to-face encounter with within a reasonable period of time to order home health services. This includes the use of telehealth. As for hospice providers, there is no negative impact on market basket update for 2010 for hospice. There is still the 1.4% increase in hospice Medicare reimbursement for the fiscal year 2010 as per the final rule. The bill mandates quality reporting regulations for hospice, and failure to report will result in a 2% cut in payment in 2014. The quality data will be available for consumers to use to choose a hospice. Hospice providers will now be required to submit additional data to CMS, including the number of days and types of service, payments, number and length of time of visits, and practitioners used for the service. This change should help hospice providers demonstrate the value of their services within the continuum of care. the new hospice regulations require physicians or nurse practitioners to have a face-to-face examination of the patient for the 180-day recertification. This is beginning January 1st, 2011. This provision is a response to the increases in the length of stay for hospice patients. Also, good news for programs of all-inclusive care for the elderly, PACE. PACE is now excluded from the Medicare Advantage cuts in the health care reform bill. On the Medicaid side, there are a number of provisions in the health care reform bill that promote the growth of home and community-based services. First, the Community First Choice option allows states to receive a 6% increase in their federal medical assistance percentage, their FMAP, if they increase the access to personal attendant care for individuals on Medicaid that have a skilled need. This option could encourage states to reduce or even eliminate Medicaid waiver waiting lists for personal care services provided by adult day providers and home care providers. It will begin October 1st, 2011. You should encourage your state governors and Medicaid director to take advantage of this benefit. There will be a report to Congress on the impact of the Community First Choice option in December of 2013 and also in December of 2015. The second provision that will increase the use of home and community-based services is the Home and Community-Based Service Rebalancing Incentive Program. And this is an optional state Medicaid program that will encourage states to spend more on home and community-based services. States that currently spend less than 25% of their total long-term service and support Medicaid budget on home and community-based services will receive a 5% increase in their federal matching fund to pay for additional home and community-based services. And states that spend less than 50% of their total long-term services and support budget on Medicaid home and community-based services will receive a 2% increase in their FMAP. If they meet target goals for rebalancing and changing their home and community-based service delivery system by October 1st, 2015. The states will have to increase their state Medicaid expenditures, such as funding for Medicaid 1915C waivers, PACE programs, home health, and personal assistance services under the Medicaid state plan in order to receive the additional federal matching funds. The states are also required to implement 3 structural reforms in order to receive this incentive payment. They need to implement, first, a no wrong door or single point of entry system, and most states are doing this now, a conflict-free case management program, and core standardized assessment. This provision will help all home and community-based service providers in the states that choose to participate in the program. You again should encourage your state governor and Medicaid director to take advantage of this benefit. This program will be in effect from October 1st, 2011 to September 30th, 2015. There are currently 30 states in the District of Columbia that are participating in the Money Follows the Person program that transitions older individuals and persons with disabilities from a nursing home back to the community. The health care reform bill improves the Money Follows the Person program. The bill extends the Money Follows the Person demonstration grant from 2011 to 2016. It also changes the residency eligibility requirement for Money Follows the Person from 6 months to 3 months residing in a nursing home, increasing the number of people eligible to be transitioned from nursing homes back to the community. The additional FMAP to states from Money Follows the Person is significant and is determined by the number of people that are transitioned based on your state Money Follows the Person plan. You should be establishing relationships with your local area agency on aging and aging and disability resource centers in order to benefit from the increased funding from the Money Follows the Person program for home and community-based service providers. Adult day services and home care services will benefit from all of these changes. The bill makes the spousal Medicaid eligibility requirement for home and community-based services to be the same as nursing home spousal Medicaid eligibility. This change will increase the number of individuals that are eligible for Medicaid waiver and state plan home and community-based services. This expansion of Medicaid eligibility is only good for the period of January 1st, 2014 to December 31st, 2018. The 1915I waivers that came out of the Deficit Reduction Act were supposed to have a positive impact on the growth of home and community-based services. Unfortunately, as of this year, only four states, Iowa, Nevada, Washington, and Colorado, were approved for this waiver. California, Wisconsin, and Texas are in the process of applying for a 1915I waiver. The health care reform bill makes the 1915I waiver more appealing to both the states and the beneficiaries. It allows states to target specific populations with no limits on scope, geographic location, duration, and comparability of services. It eliminates the state's ability to cap the number of eligible people served by the 1915I waiver, although CMS is requiring states to project the number served. These changes go into effect immediately. It changes eligibility for the 1959 state plan amendment waivers from 150% of SSI to 300% of SSI, increasing the number of individuals that can receive these services. This option will be phased in over a five-year period. Healthcare reform increases the funding for the Aging and Disability Resource Centers. Increased funding for aging and disability resource centers should help to improve the consumer's knowledge of long-term services options. It allocates $10 million a year from 2010 to 2014 for the aging and disability resource centers. The bill establishes health homes to coordinate care for individuals with chronic diseases through an optional Medicaid state plan amendment. This will be available on January 1st, 2011. Health homes are a team of health professionals that may include a physician group, a home health agency, and other providers. The patient must have at least two chronic diseases or a persistent mental health condition to be enrolled in a health home. Health homes will have to provide comprehensive case management, care coordination, patient and family support, and information and referral services. You again should discuss this program with your state Medicaid director. States can receive planning grants to initiate this program. There are a number of demonstrations that benefit home and community-based services in the health care reform bill that we will discuss in our May 27th call on opportunities for members from demonstrations and pilots. For more details on the provisions of health care reform that impact home and community-based service providers, please go to the ASA Healthcare Reform Hub on the ASA website. Now back to Barbara.
Thanks, Peter. I'll speak very briefly about the CLASS Act in order to save time for questions at the end. Most of you know the CLASS Act, or the Community Living Assistance Services and Support Act, is a voluntary, totally voluntary, federally administered consumer finance insurance plan. It became law when the president signed the health care reform law on March 22, 2010. This CLASS plan provides those who participate with cash shall pay for needed assistance if they become functionally limited in a place they call home, from independent living to a nursing facility if they choose. This is one of the real game changers in the health care reform law. It is one of the very, very few elements that the highly respected and neutral Congressional Budget Office scored or said would actually save substantial money for Medicaid over the coming years. It changes the opportunities for ordinary Americans to help finance their own long-term care with planning ahead in an affordable choices. Ultimately, it can provide new payment sources for the good services provided by providers of aging services, all with a choice of the focus of the consumer's or customer's choice. The most frequent question we get asked is, when can we sign up? We have details on a document called Class Act Basics on our hub that answers this and other questions, but let me give you this one that we most frequently get asked. Most provisions of the Class Act are, quote, effective January 1, 2011, but before people can begin signing up to participate, the Secretary of Health and Human Services must develop the details of the plan and implement it. The law requires the Secretary to release the details of the plan no later than October 1, 2012, so it is likely that people will be able to sign up sometime after that, let's say around January 1, 2013. People who choose to participate pay in for 5 years before being eligible for the benefit if needed. So it is likely to be that this insurance money will start to flow back into the care and services sometime around 2018. So I say this is one of the real game changers, and we invite you to learn more at the ASA Health Reform Hub. Susan?
Thank you all. We have questions in the queue, and I'd like to repeat the first one. It is this. We currently offer group coverage to employees who work 30 hours and up. Do we need to cover part-time employees that work less than 30 hours? I'm going to ask Iara to handle that.
Okay, so you're talking about full-time employees versus part-time employees. As I mentioned, you're not required by law to cover part-time employees if you offer coverage for full-time employees. But if you do offer coverage for part-time employees, the provisions that I just mentioned and the benefits must apply equally to the part-time employees. So the simple answer is no, you don't have to cover those part-time employees. Come 2014, the same thing applies. You're not required to cover the part-time employees, or in fact, you're not required to cover even full-time employees. But in 2014, the difference is that the part-time employees will count towards the threshold number that determines whether you're a large employer or a smaller employer, and therefore subject to certain penalty under certain circumstances.
Is that okay? All right, the second one is also on employment for Iara, and it is, how will the small employer tax credit be factored for nonprofits?
Okay, the tax credit will be a refundable credit based on payroll taxes. This is the taxes that not-for-profits pay, so it will be based on that. But we don't know the details yet, and so it's still there are still regulations that will come out on that, and we probably will be hearing something very soon on that. So we'll make sure that we update the website with that information. But as far as we know, no details yet on that.
Thank you, Leah. The third question is for Peter, and it is, what does conflict-free case management entail, and/or how is it defined?
Conflict-free case management actually refers to the targeted case management rule that was rescinded last year. It refers to having a single case manager who's directing care and working with other providers or other specialties to assure that there isn't multiple case managers that are billing or directing care for the individual. It's just to assure an efficiency in the case management process.
Okay. Advisor, no more questions in the queue. So I'm going to say goodbye and thank you so much for us. I also want to acknowledge and thank Larson Allen and Dixon Hughes for their ongoing analysis of health reform, and enjoy the rest of your week. Thanks again for joining us.